2345 54321. Test 12345 54321. I hereby authorize Paul Cecil to use the material contained in my ranch and oral history interview tapes, or tape, for scholarly research and publication. I agree at Paul's discretion that these tapes may be kept in the archives of Texas A&M University and will be made available for historical research and study after any period Paul so deems appropriate without restriction. John R. Spade. Major USAF, retired, 850 Tarpon Drive, Fort Walton Beach, Florida. Interview tape number S-7101. Paul, on this, I'm also going to further discuss items on the questionnaire. Item number 9, decorations. I was awarded the DFC that resulted from an airplane. One of my airplane was shot up pretty bad on a descent in the target, with one engine being damaged on the descent, and during the target itself, the other engine was shot out, and it looked for a period of time like we were going to have to ditch the airplane in the mud flat off from Comau. The tide was out at the time. However, we were able to gain enough altitude going up the coast and to where we felt it was safe to cross the coast and head into Sauk Trang. Landed at the Sauk Trang. The airplane was shot up pretty good. As I recall, there was three tires had been punctured, and the airplane sustained about 18 or 19 hits. There was no one wounded on board. As far as special missions and operations, because I joined the unit when the unit first went over there, every new mission that we flew was generally new and special. Initially, the work was limited to lines of communication, such as alongside roads, railroads, some camp perimeter work. I was also involved in flying the initial crop destruction targets once we got into the crop destruction work in 63, early 64. I was also involved in the initial work in what we would term rough terrain when we were starting to do mountain work, which was largely crop. And this sort of flying had never been done before, so we were having develop techniques. For the basic obvious technique is always flying downhill. This type of thing, we had to feel our way through that, and it was all pretty exciting. I was also involved in the initial work along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which, as I recall, started in fall of 1965. Item 13, I was part of a flight in which one of the navigators, Tony Nitch, was wounded in the face as a result of fragmentations hitting him as a result of small arms fire. During the period of time I was over there, I also was involved in transporting U.S. and Vietnamese officials for coordination meetings at district or province headquarters or province level, where we discussed particular areas, or they would have to ascertain the capability of the mission itself in terms of being able to spray it and what effect it might have for target selection. And these coordination meetings were attended by quite often the lead crew, who might end up being the lead crew, or at least one of the navigators that would be involved in the mission itself, to more familiarize ourselves with the area. Item 18, I left blank because I wasn't involved in the you know, in the maintenance business. Night Up 19 will be discussed later in the my own personal remembrances. And I think I'll try to bring out number 20, item 21 in that general narrative as far as the uniqueness of the mission and particular problems associated with it. As far as item 23 is concerned, I thoroughly enjoyed Vietnam, otherwise I, and the mission, otherwise I wouldn't have spent the amount of time that I did involved with it. I was not involved in any way with the initial, you know, any of the high-level planning that went into the formation of the unit that soon became known as Operation Ranchan. I first became interested when a team from the Special Aerial Spray Flight at Langley Air Force Base, Captains Carl Marshall, Robbie Robinson, and Carlson, I've forgotten Carlson's first name now, came to Pope and I'm sure met with a wing commander at Pope at the time, which was a C-123 wing at Pope Air Force Base with five squadrons. The wing was asked to assist in obtaining additional pilots to augment the pilots from the Special Aerial Spray Flight in forming the unit. Additional pilots were necessary, of course, simply to get the airplanes to Vietnam, and the Special Aerial Spray Flight realized that the unit would need additional people and would have to train those people in spraying techniques in order to build and have available the flight crews that they would need to conduct the mission. Each squadron was asked to canvass its pilots to see if anyone was interested in becoming part of another unit, and the mission, of course, was classified secret for TDY overseas, and basically that's all we were told. Approximately 15 individuals volunteered from the air crew standpoint. Maintenance, of course, was maintenance cadre was put together from maintenance personnel from Pope. About 15 of us, younger officers, for the most part, captains and lieutenants, indicated interest. We were then given a very general briefing, since the mission was classified at the time, to ascertain whether a briefing and an interview by the people from Langley to ascertain whether we might be interested. We had to sign a secrecy pledge. We were not told where we were going overseas, but if anyone read the magazines and kept up with the news in 1961, it was fairly obvious that we certainly weren't going to Europe. I decided that myself personally that it sounded like an interesting mission, although we weren't given any specifics. We weren't told that it was a spray mission, and we weren't told that it was Vietnam, but I had a feeling it was Vietnam. I didn't at the time And since the people were from the special aerial spray flight at Langley, I could assume that it was going to be some sort of a spraying operation. Spraying what, I didn't know. And we weren't told. But it sounded interesting, so I volunteered and I was accepted. I was the second lieutenant at the time. And had been stationed at Pope about 12, 13 months. And I was combat crew qualified co-pilot at the time. In September or October of 1961, the team from Langley, as I recall, returned again, and we were for an additional briefing, and which detailed or went into simply the deployment as far as Travis Air Base, California. And we were put on TDY orders and assigned to the 4500th Air Base Wing at Langley Air Force Base, which the Special Area Spray Flight was a flight of that wing. We were told that we were given the deployment date, which was going to be the day after Thanksgiving in November 61. Of course, the airplanes, the 6C-123s, had gone to Hagerstown. Not Hagerstown, but the one in Pennsylvania. C-123s had been sent to Olmsted, Pennsylvania, and AMA at that time. The six airplanes had been modified. The spray tank had been installed, and that spray tank, the 1,000-gallon spray tank, was going to be used as the auxiliary fuel tank, and the necessary plumbing was installed and a small pump to transfer the fuel from the 1,000-gallon spray tank into the main nacelle tanks. Additionally, a 55-gallon drum of oil was installed with pump and valves to replenish the oil supply in the engines should oil transfer be necessary. The aircraft were then returned to Pope and overwater equipment, of course, was placed on board, survival gear and so forth. We were crewed as a crew of three pilots and one navigator. And as much as the 123 wasn't autopiloted, and we knew that the Pacific crossing involved at least two legs of anywhere from 15 to 17 hours each. We had three pilots and one nav on board each airplane, plus one flight engineer. Plan was to depart Pope Air Force Base and fly to Travis Airport Air Force Base nonstop. This would allow us to check the cruise control data for that particular airplane, the oil consumption, so that we could anticipate how much to transfer and how often, and as much as we didn't have oil quantity gauges for the engines. The headwind component in November and early December across the Midwest is fairly strong, and our ground speeds were fairly slow through Oklahoma and Arizona in that area. And one of the airplanes developed a problem with a auxiliary tank, tip tank, and he was unable to transfer. The book said he should have jettisoned it, but he landed it at George Air Force Base because he didn't have enough gas to make it, or didn't feel he had enough gas to make it into Travis. So we all landed at George Air Force Base, and the following day flew on to Travis. The airplanes following the C-123 was a C-124 that was carrying the flyaway kits, the maintenance personnel, and spares for the to enable maintenance to keep the airplanes up to speed for the deployment and for the initial work that would be done, the initial maintenance that would be needed in the Philippines and later on in Saigon at Tansanud Airport. We spent a day and a half or so at Travis getting the airplanes ready to go and took off about 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm not sure the morning, but it would have been the 28th or 29th of November. We took off in the dark as a flight of two with block altitudes. The reason that they paired us up was so that the navigators could navigate. One navigator could handle navigation for 3 or 4 hours and then by radio give the position and ground speed and so forth to the other nav. And we went at 8,000 and 10,000 feet, so we were in sight of your partner airplane 1,000 or 2,000 feet below you. The trip to Honolulu, or to Hickam, was uneventful with the exception of one airplane was forced to turn back, so his partner airplane turned back with him and arrived at Honolulu the following day. He had turned back due to maintenance, and I don't recall what the problem was. The flight across took about 16 and a half, 17 hours to Honolulu. I believe we stayed a day and a half or 2 days at Hickam just to kind of rest up after a fairly long trip. Then the following day we flew to Johnson Island, refueled at Johnson, and flew on to Wake to break up that 2,000 mile leg of flying into Johnson. We stayed on Johnson just long enough to top off the tanks and then press the remaining 11 or 1200 miles into Wake Island. The following day it was Guam, and as I recall, we just RON'd at Guam, and the following day Clark Air Base in the Philippines. The unit was at that time was designated the tactical Paul, I think that was a Tactical Air Transport Squadron Provisional 1. I'll try to recall that unit name for you in a little bit. Tactical Air Provisional Squadron Number 1. And the code name was Ranchan, or Operation Ranchan. We arrived at Clark on the 9th of December in the path of a typhoon, and a typhoon that was coming up the Philippine archipelago from the south. About 2 days later, the typhoon evacuation at Clark Air Base was ordered, and we flew up to Kadena, all six airplanes. The typhoon actually skirted Clark, and we were given the all clear, and we flew back to Clark. At this point, we, through cooperation with the Philippine Air Force, started flying some practice missions over the water of an offshore gunnery range, doing our basic 9270 spraying maneuvers and learning crew coordination and so forth as it affected level terrain. And we were flying with the pilots from the spray flight at Langley for this training, and started as spray co-pilots. We flew a number of missions from Clark. It was a 30-minute flight across the island of Luzon to the east coast of the island, where we simulated spray training, or simulated spraying. We weren't actually dispensing anything. The airplanes didn't have any spray booms on them at the time. During this period, the commander, Carl Marshall, and his ops officer, and Ed Carlson, Robbie Robinson and Ed Carlson, flew one of the birds to Saigon to discuss the mission with the second ADVON personnel, the MAG personnel, who in turn discussed the mission further with the Vietnamese. And it was the maintenance personnel were divided up, and some of them remained in the Philippines to maintain the four airplanes, and some of them deployed to Tansanud Air Base, which was just in the process of building a small tent city at the southern end of what later became just a parking ramp, but the old north-south runway. And the Ranchan maintenance people were the first occupants of that tent city. Airman Magazine in early 62 had an article about the men moving in there, showed pictures of our people as the tents were erected and the guys were getting settled in. The officers looked for and obtained apartments down in downtown Saigon. Those of us that remained in the Philippines, with the exception of our practice flights, didn't have a whole lot to do. Spent a lot of time laying around the pool at the O Club at Clark. In January, I believe the date was January the 15th, the first C-123 with Fergus Groves, Captain Fergie Groves, as the AC, crashed near Vung Tau along Highway 15 leading from Saigon to Vung Tau. It was on a practice mission, not spraying any material but just low-level maneuvering, when this crash occurred. And it was never determined whether it was a result of ground fire or simply maintenance or pilot error. It was just undeterminable. It's probably not likely that it was due to ground fire, because that particular area at that particular time in history was relatively secure. You could freely drive back and forth between Saigon and Vung Tau, Cap St. Jack, as it was known in those days. When that airplane went down, an additional C-123 was deployed immediately to bring the number back up to two in country, and that's when I was sent to Saigon and flew over there on a 124 cargo bird, first into Da Nang and then down to Saigon, where I was met by the guys over at the passenger terminal at the international airport side of the ramp. And I arrived there on the 19th of February, 2 days before the A1s bombed the Royal Palace, or the Presidential Palace. After I arrived there, we started flying simulated spray missions for practice over an agriculture area, or a rice growing area, west of Saigon. And we'd go back, it was simply one ship, and occasionally we put a two-ship formation on there, fly both birds, just the two birds that remained in Vietnam. The other three now were still back in the Philippines. These flights were flown without dispensing anything. In fact, the airplanes were empty. We didn't have any water or any to simulate heavy weight. The Initial spray equipment in the airplane consisted of a 15-horsepower motor and wing booms only. The first areas that were sprayed was an area adjacent to Highway 15 on the road to Cap St. Jack. It was sprayed once at a deposition rate of 1 gallon per acre. After the effects were observable, Vietnamese agricultural personnel, Army civilian agricultural personnel, and Army Chemical Corps personnel went out and observed and inspected on the ground. Again, it was a secure area, to evaluate the effects of the herbicide. And at this time, we were spraying 2,4-D. It was a result of their recommendation that the feasibility of application of herbicides in an attempt to increase vertical visibility, horizontal visibility, and deter the effect of ambush and so forth along the lines of communication had merit. An additional sortie was flown in the Comal Peninsula near Father Waugh's stronghold over a different type of foliage, primarily mangrove and swamp. And that area was evaluated as to the effect of the herbicide, and again, was it a worthwhile mission? And it was obviously determined that the mission had merit. Those missions were flown in January and February of 62. A lot of study took place, and while all the study was going on, for the next 3 or 4 months, we, or the ranch hand group, didn't do any spraying while the evaluation was under, while the whole idea was undergoing evaluation. Since we had all been airlifters back in the States, we started flying cargo missions with Operation Mule Train, which was the code name for the deployment of the first C-123 squadron, the 346th Air Commando Squadron from Pope. That squadron deployed en masse as a CASAF move to Saigon, and I don't remember exactly when they arrived there, but it was right around Christmas time of 61. The 346 happened to be my parent squadron back at Pope. So Carl Marshall, the detachment commander, allowed us simply to go and fly with them. And in fact, we used our airplanes, since we weren't doing anything else with them, to augment the aircraft in Operation Mule Train, and in essence went in the trash hauling business again. In midsummer of 62, in early fall, we started flying more spray missions. And it was during this period of time that the agricultural experts and the chemical people decided that it would be important or advantageous to increase the rate, the deposition rate, the number of gallons per acre. Some modifications were done to the plumbing that would allow us to dispense 1.5 gallons per acre, and that was pretty much the maximum that could be dispensed with the existing booms and plumbing and pump motor. At the same time, the it was determined by the agriculture people that the 1.5 gallons per acre, probably, particularly in the dormant season, of plant dormant season in terms of the life cycle of the plant. That it was at the same period of time, this is side two now of tape number one, at the same time it was determined that it was probably going to be necessary. It was determined at this time also by the agricultural people and through observation that the application rate at 1.5 gallons per hour wasn't, particularly in the dormant season, wasn't going to hack the program. It simply wasn't going to produce the kill. So that we were told to double the application. Well, we couldn't do it with the plumbing. The only way we were able to do it was to fly the target twice, which we started doing. If there was a question of security, we'd fly it the first time, and if we received ground fire and lead decided that as much as the surprise was gone, that we would not fly over a target twice the same day. So we'd leave that target and go to another one, and then reschedule it for to be flown for the second application, you know, at a 2 or 3, 4 or 5 days later, in order to get 3 gallons to an acre on a particular target. And the 3 gallons per acre figure was used pretty much for the remainder of, certainly the remainder of the time I was there through 66, through the middle of 66. Later on, the plumbing was enlarged and a tail boom was added that allowed a deposition rate of 3 gallons to be obtained on a single pass. And this eliminated the need to refly a target once it was flown. The early spray work was in 62 and 63, for the most part, was limited to lines of communication, canals, roadways, power lines. We sprayed the power line from the hydroelectric dam in Dalat down the mountain into the flat in an effort to kill the foliage and grass and so forth along the major lines of communication to prevent ambush. This was not a new concept. It had been used during the French Indochina War in Indochina and to some degree in the Malaysian conflict. The French did it somewhat differently. They simply put road crews out there and cut the stuff down and then turned cattle on the area to eat the grass, and opening up a swath maybe 50 to 100 yards on either side of major highway links. And you could still see the effect of this effort in Vietnam, most notably Highway 13 leading north from Saigon. In any case, the idea of vegetation control along lines of communication to deter and reduce the effects of ambush was not a new idea. The aerial application in a large scale that we were involved with using herbicides was, although some herbicides again were used, and so I understand, in the Malaysian conflict, but sprayed from vehicles. In late 63, it seems to me, or in very early 64, we got involved in our first crop destruction, food denial. The theory being there, if we could, in areas that were not under the control of the Republic of Vietnam, if we could destroy the enemy's crops, we could place additional burden on his logistics system. Initially, most of this work was done in the mountainous areas and in areas that obviously were not under the control of the Republic of Vietnam. And by 65, our target areas were generally split between straight defoliation for visibility and in the area of crop denial. In 65, we started using, in an attempt to get better results from the herbicide, we started using 2,4-D-2,4-5-T, orange. And the experts agreed that we were getting a little bit better results as a result, and affecting a broader spectrum of plants as a result of the utilization of orange. However, purple and the purple scarf, of course, comes from the purple scarf comes from the code name for the 2,4-D. In 1965, the use of the eastern reaches of Laos as what became known as the Ho Chi Minh Trail was in its relative infancy, although that area had been used for infiltration during the French War as well. However, we were asked to, or told to, go out and survey the trail south of Highway 9 and start spraying areas that had been where traffic had been observed in order to kill additional foliage along the trail, allowing for better vertical visibility and surveillance. These missions were flown by the detachment flying out of Da Nang. We were receiving enough target requests for defoliation and crop targets in the northern part of the country that in 65 we established a small detachment, and the guys rotated. We'd go to Da Nang for a week or 10 days or whatever it was, I don't recall, and then spray for the targets in the northern part of the country out of there, since it was a pretty long haul to go all the way up to MR1 out of Saigon. And there was one occasion where we operated temporarily out of Nha Trang for crop missions in and around Military Region 3. And the Da Nang detachment became a pretty much permanent. Throughout the period of time when the unit was stationed in Saigon, the enlisted personnel were quartered on base in tents and hooches, and the air crew were living downtown. And we got back and forth. Some of us had motorcycles, and a couple of the guys even bought a couple of old automobiles, and we'd drive from downtown Saigon out to the base in the morning. In 64, up until about March of 1964, the aircrew requirement was supported solely on a TDY basis from personnel of the operational, or from the special aerial spray flight at Langley, the mosquito birds, the mosquito flight. And there was a couple of us, myself included, who desired to stay in the ranch, and we were PCS'd from Pope to the special aerial spray flight at Langley, and then simply returned to Vietnam on TDY orders to be the air crew for the unit in Vietnam. However, by 1964, it was obvious that the mission was going to be a permanent type mission. It was having the desired effect, if albeit sometimes disappointing in some areas that you would spray. The people at TAC headquarters realized that the personnel from Operation Ranch Hand sooner or later were going to have to be, rather than just rotating the same group from the Special Aerial Spray Flight, were going to have to come from USAF resources. In March of 64, the unit then received its first permanent or PCS personnel, and they were assigned to the unit. They were volunteers to be in Operation Ranch Hand, and they were assigned PCS. And as the TDYs ended, it was about this same time of year where the period of time when the C-123 in the transport squadrons went from a TDY status to a one-year PCS. And this was started about in March of 1964. The personnel coming to the ranch at that time would go through transition in the C-123 at Pope Air Force Base and then go to the Special Aerial Spray Flight at Langley for the specialized spray training, and then would come to Vietnam, assigned to the ranch. The organizationally, we went from a detachment to a flight under the transport squadron, and we were kind of a bastard unit from an administrative standpoint, although we were cohesive as far as the mission, you know, the actual mission was concerned. We were attached to the transport group for a while as a detachment, then we were later called Flight C, I think, of the 315th Troop Carrier Squadron, which was the redesignation of Operation Mule Train after things started to become permanent in Vietnam and as the Air Force structure evolved throughout the history of the Vietnam conflict. In Tan Son's, or Saigon Airport, started to get more crowded as more units were deployed in to Southeast Asia, and the decision was made to relocate Operation Ranch Hand to Benoit, and that occurred in late September or early October of 1966. By this time, the unit had grown in size and numbers of airplanes. The original six airplanes, and of course one was crashed, in leaving us with five. In mid-summer of 66, early spring of 66, while we received two or three more airplanes, and then the unit was expanded with air crew, and those air crew ferried a couple of additional airplanes across the Pacific, raising it to a total of about nine aircraft by mid-66. And in late September, early October, the unit was moved from its original and permanent location on the SAM ramp at Saigon to Benoit. And on the 15th of October, 1966, it was designated as a squadron. The command of Major Ralph Dresser, Paul. The uniqueness of the mission resulted in a strong sense of camaraderie and a high sense of esprit de corps very early on. And one of the ways that it manifested itself, I suppose, was while we wore the same flying fatigues and as the other airlift squadrons, we wanted to look different. The first item we adopted was a green beret. It wasn't the Special Forces Army green beret color, but it was actually the Vietnamese Ranger green color. And we all went down and bought green berets. And we put the Vietnamese rank, the insignia for our Vietnamese rank, on that green beret. One of the reasons that the Vietnamese rank was used was the fact that for a period of time in 64, the fighter cover that we utilized was an outgrowth of President Zim, special fighter group, which at that time was General Keyes' special black suit fighter group. We were fairly close to them because the Ranch Hand building, the Quonset hut that operations and supply was housed in, was adjacent to General Keyes' hangar and just behind the house that he lived in on the base. That ramp that he occupied in that hangar was the SAM ramp when Ngo Dinh Diem was president of the country prior to the coup in November of 62. We occupied that building from day one, and we socialized to some degree with a number of the pilots that were part of General Keyes' black suit, they wore black flying suits, as part of his special detachment of his special squadron, you might say the Coup Busters. And so we ended up wearing the green berets until the Army became upset with it. They didn't like the idea of us wearing green berets, so finally the Air Force General was instructed to tell our commander to Ranch Hand had to get rid of the green berets, so we, of course, obviously did. This camaraderie that developed with the Vietnamese, with President Keyes, or General Key at that time, Colonel Key, I guess, led to the unit being presented with Vietnamese Air Force wings, flying wings, which became a tradition. At the original ceremony that we received VNAV wings each of us were also presented with a lavender scarf, the same color that General Key wore as the commander of the Air Force. And this, it was the same color that was worn by his pilots and their black flying suits. The ranch hand, and of course these were really appreciated, and the fact that they're right out of the same bolt of cloth that General Key and his Air Force and his A-1 fighter pilots had their scarves made from. As different individuals came to Operation Ranch Hand, the different air crew, we tried to obtain additional lavender scarves for them. And we scoured Saigon up and down, and we could never find the material. So the closest thing to it was purple. And from that point on, from about 65 on, the majority of us wore purple scarves, because we were unable to obtain the lavender scarf. And of course, then there was the association with the purple scarf and the 24D being referred to as simply purple. And that's pretty much how the purple scarf got started. If I can take just a minute to talk about the patch, the ranch hand patch. The ranch hand patch, to my knowledge, was never officially approved by Air Force and underwent the normal approval procedures that units go through to have a patch approved by the USAF. I may be wrong, but it certainly never followed that routine in the early part of the time. We decided that we needed a patch about 1964. And then Lieutenant George Adams, who's now Lieutenant Colonel, and Al Kidd, who was a captain at the time, and I'm pretty sure Al is probably retired by now, they were pretty decent artists, and they sat down and designed what became the Ranch Hand patch. The green with the brown swath through the center of it was obviously the jungle turned brown by the herbicide. The Chinese character is the Chinese character, so we were told, for purple, the color purple. So purple makes the brown, makes the jungle turn, the green jungle turn brown, so you've got the interior colors. And the yellow and gold, of course, was the colors of the Republic of Vietnam. And that's pretty much how the patch was, or the reason for the design and the reason for the choice of colors for the Ranch Hand patch. And Paul, your search into the official Air Force records will probably determine whether the patch was ever formally approved or submitted even for approval. But of course it was worn from day one, and they were produced locally by the local made locally at the local clothing or tailor shops there in town, in Saigon. In talking about the development of, or the evolution of some of the tactics, most of the initial work that we did was in flat country and over forested areas or over jungle areas. And for the most part, we flew with fighter cover. In the early days, we used B-26s, A-1s, and I say early days, 62, 3, 4. As those aircraft were being replaced by jet aircraft, then we started using F-100s. And the F-5s weren't too good because their fuel availability wasn't, they just simply didn't have the endurance. If we were doing targets, say, out of Saigon all the way down to the south, and the Comal Peninsula and areas like that. For the most part, we held the fighters in the event that an airplane were to be receive damage. The first tactic that we used was primarily to take advantage of surprise. Arrive at a target at first light, get on in, get it sprayed, and just climb on out as rapidly as possible. And the fighters were held at altitude and to be utilized only if we received significant ground fire or to be available in the event that an airplane was to have to force land and then be available to provide fighter or close air support for the helicopters. Depending on the intelligent assessment we often had a helicopter on ground standby at a nearby airfield. And again, if the threat was felt to be a little bit greater, we might have him airborne. They were generally held back and behind the approach of the C-123s so that the element of surprise wouldn't be destroyed. If we were to receive ground fire, we started utilizing smoke grenades, pitching the flight engineer upon command from the pilot, would pull the pin on a smoke grenade and throw it out the crew entrance or the troop jump doors, which were tied open in the open position. Later on, our missions, if they were crop destruction missions where you could anticipate more opposition, and as much as if you've got crops, you got people, and if you got people, you have opposition, we started utilizing a FAC as well. And the purpose of the FAC, of course, was that after we would mark the approximate location or the where we were when we received ground fire, where then they would fly in a little bit lower their normal vacuum altitude and attempt to locate the origin of the ground of the opposition. And if they could, well, then they might employ the fighters on that particular area. But for the most part, we tried to use the element of surprise and get a target sprayed and get in and out. There were some occasions where we were operating in areas of that where we anticipated opposition immediately, and occasionally pre-strike was utilized. But for the most part, we felt that, and at least it was my own personal view, that you go in and pre-strike beforehand, and they're all up and mad and angry, and then pretty soon here comes a lumbering C-123, and you get just as much, if not more, opposition than you would if you just tried to sneak in and hit them at, you know, get into a target at first light, get on through it, and come on, you know, and climb on out. However, pre-strike was utilized in some areas. Then we also experimented, and depending on the target arrangement or layout of the target, where we'd come in at about 3,500 feet, approach the target, get the airplane set up in formation with extended spacing, Then make a rapid descent to spray altitude and start your spraying. On occasion, it was also, we on occasion used a technique where we'd make a rapid descent to a literally an on-the-deck situation. Again, the lower you are, the more difficult it is for someone with small arms to swing on you because of